All right, thank you all for coming. We're going to everybody take their seats. We'll do that sitting. My name is Grant Quest. I'm a reporter at Catholic Standard, and I'm going to be your moderator this evening. Tonight's debate is brought to you by the Niagara Secular Humanist. And I'd like to thank everybody involved in organizing tonight's debate, as well as our two distinguished guests. Having attended these sort of events in the past, I know how irritating it is when the moderator gets up and tries to talk about his own self-importance and kind of bores the audience to death, but I promise to keep my opening comments brief. In 45 BCE, the great Roman orator Cicero wrote a very famous book called The Nature of the Gods, which was in the form of a letter to his friend Brutus. And as those of you who know Roman history, it's that Brutus, the guy who kills poor Julius Caesar. Early in the opening chapters of his book, Cicero poses the essential question for his entire thesis, and he writes, "On this subject of the nature of the gods, the first question is, do the gods exist or not? It is difficult, you may say, to deny that the gods exist. I would agree if we were arguing the matter for a public assembly, but in a private discussion of this kind, it is perfectly easy to do so." The reason he opens with this question is quite simple. If you cannot settle the question of do the gods, or in our case, God, exist, everything else based upon it almost becomes irrelevant, doesn't it? So that's our subject for the evening. Does God exist? And it's as important a question today, in the 21st century, as it was when poor Cicero wrote it only two short years before he died during the death throes of the once mighty Roman Empire. Sitting in God's corner this evening is, for those of you who are from St. Catherine, is Peter Youngman, who has been involved in Christian ministry for over 30 years and is the minister at the Niagara Celebration Church, formerly called the Word of Life. Peter is a well-known face of St. Catherine's and in fact around the world. His ministry has taken him to Africa, Asia, Malaysia. He's quite a bit of reading in non-Christian countries, and you probably catch him on television where he's on somewhere in the country or somewhere in the world at least once a day. The honorable opposition is Mr. Dan Barker from Wisconsin. He is the co-president of the Freedom from Religion Foundation, and he is the author of Losing Faith in Faith. He was a preacher for some time before becoming an atheist. And I just remind you all, before we get underway, the materials, both from Peter and from Dan, can be found at the table on the other side of the room. Tonight's format is going to be pretty straightforward. We're going to do a coin toss in the moment to decide which of these gentlemen will speak first. They'll be followed by a 15-minute introductory remarks by both speakers, and then there'll be a 5-minute back and forth conversation between the two of them for about an hour, and we'll just see how long the debate actually goes on. We'll then have a 10-minute break, followed by a Q&A session from the members of the audience. So if I could have Peter Youngman, you could call heads or tails in the air for me, please, sir.
Oh, heads.
It's tails. Mark, would you choose to speak first, or will that be Mr. Youngman? All right, well, Mr. Youngman, or Mr. Barker will speak first, gentlemen. I will keep you to your time limit strictly for your 5 minutes. Watch your rabbit punches, watch your kidney punches, and protect yourselves at all times. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a warm up for Mr. Dan Barker.
Can we do something about the sound system, please?
This mic here, I think, is bad. Can you hear me okay? Well, okay. I can't pray about this. So president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We are America's largest organization of atheists and agnostics, specifically representing atheists and agnostics. We have more than 12,000. We work to keep state and church separate and to educate the public about the views and the benefits and beautiful history of non-belief, the contributions that non-believers have made to the world. I wasn't always working for that group. I used to be an ordained Christian minister, Bible-believing, God-loving, Jesus-preaching, soul-winning, cross-country evangelist, missionary to Mexico for 2 years. I was an associate pastor at beautiful churches in California. I was a Christian songwriter, and I'm still getting royalties today from Christian music that I love, which is fun. And I was also a cross-country evangelist for 8 years, really believing. The Bible says you shall know them by their fruits. Some people say I couldn't have been a real Christian or I never would have left. Well, if I was not a true Christian, nobody is. I believed it, I lived it, I devoted my life to it, and I loved it at the time. I can't tell you that story tonight, but over a 4 or 5 year period, I changed my mind. I realized that what I was preaching is false, that the Bible is unreliable, the Bible is contradictory, it is not a good basis for truth or for morality. We're better off using reason, kindness, humanistic morality over superstition and faith and dogma. What day of the week is it today? Wednesday. You know what that means? The day of Woden. There was a god named Woden, a pagan god, who was worshipped by millions of people. And in fact, there's still some people today who worship Woden. Are any of you in the audience tonight? Are there any worshippers of Woden? No? Are you all skeptics? You don't believe in Woden? Millions of people. We have a day of the week named after Woden or Woden. People live their lives, born and dying, believing in this god. But none of you here do, I guess. What about the Greek god? What about Zeus, the god of thunder? Anybody here believe in the Greek god Zeus? No? So far. What about any Roman god? What about Diana? They have some equal opportunities. What was Diana? Hunting? Huntress? No believer in Diana? No? Here's a possibility. What about Allah? New believers here? Allah, there's one, okay? Or two, okay? So far, most of us are atheists. There was a Middle Eastern god, a war god, who said, my name is Jealous. And he was described in some Hebrew scriptures, his name was Elohim, or sometimes known as Yahweh. Any believers of that Middle Eastern war god there in the Bible tonight, named Elohim or Yahweh? Yes, there are. There are some. I guess Peter is believing in that God. You don't believe in Elohim of the Old Testament? Elohim is what I'm talking about. He is a god of war, and he says, my name is Jealous. I know what. And he exterminated tribes who disagreed with him, and he was a god of war. And the Israelites believe in him. Now, some people here believe in him, maybe you don't. But the only difference between you and me is that I just believe in one less god than you do. We're all atheists when it comes to someone else's god. It's easy to see how silly Zeus was. They used to think the noises in the sky needed an explanation, so there's a Thor or there's a Zeus. But now, we don't need that explanation anymore. We understand electricity. We understand a little bit about the weather. And that god has died. That gap has closed. There are still some gaps in our understanding of the world. There are so many gaps. And today, modern believers tend to fill those as yet open gaps with their particular god. In Canada, in the United States, it happens to be primarily the god of the Bible, the god Elohim, the war god of the Old Testament, who had a son, by the way. He got a woman pregnant somehow, who was a virgin, and he had a son named Jesus. And Jesus was supposed to be the anointed Christ one, so most of the followers of this war god of the Bible call themselves Christians. The burden of proof in any debate is on the shoulders of the person who makes the assertion. The theist says, there is a God, or I believe in God. The atheist simply says, I don't have a belief in God. I don't have that belief. If Peter was believing in leprechauns, he's free to do so, it would not be incumbent on me to disprove his belief in leprechauns. There is evidence for leprechauns, by the way. There are people who believe in the existence of leprechauns. There are stories about leprechauns. There's pictures about leprechauns. There's a history. There's a legend. There's mythology. There's a big lore of leprechauns. How many in this room believe in leprechauns? Any Irish here? No? I've met some people who believe in leprechauns. But It would not be incumbent on me to disprove your belief in leprechauns. You're the one with the belief that's extra from what we both share. It is your responsibility to prove to me that, in fact, what you are claiming is true. Now, if there's one thing that is obvious about the existence of God, is that the existence of God is not obvious. If it were, we would be having a debate like this. If the existence of God were something we would all know, there would be no atheists. We would all think, oh, of course, there is a God. There are six reasons that I'm going to give tonight briefly why I don't believe in God, and I don't think you should either. First is there's no evidence. There's no evidence at all. I used to preach that there were all these miracles and prophecies and answers to prayer and the Bible and the resurrection of Jesus and so on. But as you scratch beneath the surface, the evidence disappeared. The same evidence for Santa Claus or for leprechauns. It's there. But when you scratch beneath the surface, you realize that it's a product of human creativity and myth making. If there were evidence for a God, think about this. If there really were, right? If there were some kind of evidence that came close to proof, by now someone should have won the Nobel Prize for it. Right? Every scientist in the world would jump at a chance to demonstrate the existence of a hitherto unknown force in the cosmos, wouldn't they? Anybody would love to do that. Why haven't they done that? Why has that not been done? Why are we still having debates? Does God exist? It's obvious that there is no evidence for a God. Faith is not evidence. Faith is acting as a surrender. If you have to have faith to believe that God exists, then you are surrendering. What if scientists were to get together every weekend, hold hands in a circle, start singing and praying, yes, gravity is real. I know gravity is real. I believe in my heart that what goes up, up, up must come down, down, down. Amen. What if they did that? Every week they got together and they reinforced each other and said, yes, have faith. Be strong. Don't yield to temptation. Just keep believing in gravity. You would think they were pretty insecure on the concept, wouldn't you? If that's what we see believers doing, they get together. Be strong. Have faith. Don't yield. If it were a fact, we wouldn't need faith. Faith is a surrender of fact. Second, there is no coherent definition of a God. Every theology defines it in a different way. And very few theists actually make their statement that God exists falsifiable. If you're going to claim that there is a God, then there must be statements which can be made which, if true, would prove that there's not a God. And the failure to provide or substantiate those falsifiable statements actually strengthens your claim that there's a God. If we found one black polar bear, if we did, that would falsify the statement that all polar bears are white. So I'm going to ask Peter tonight to give me an example of a statement which would, if true, falsify theism. Not that it is true, but if true, that it wouldn't make your hypothesis false. And if you want to ask me what would cause me to change my mind, you're welcome to do so. And some of the definitions of God are contradictory. You'd be like arguing, does a married bachelor exist? Well, we can argue and argue, but by definition, such a thing cannot exist. And there are definitions of God, for example, of God is a being with free will who knows the future. If you know the future, then you don't have free will. You can't have both. If God has free will and God knows the future, then he knows his own future actions. Therefore, he does not have the power to change his own future actions before he gets there. Therefore, he has no free will. One of those has to go. If God is defined as a free will being who can make decisions and who knows the future, that God is a married bachelor. That God, by definition, cannot exist. Number three, there are no good arguments for the existence of a God. Theists over the centuries have tried to present arguments from design, from cosmology, from first cause, the teleological design arguments. There's the ontological group of arguments that Bertrand Russell was momentarily convinced when he was a teenager that there was a God by the ontological argument, but he thought a little bit deeper and he said, all these arguments just boil down to bad grammar. And he jettisoned any idea. These arguments might look good to a believer, but when you scratch beneath the surface, these arguments are really bad arguments. The argument for morality, for example. Number four, there is no agreement among God believers as to the nature or the moral principles of this God that they think exists. You name it. Pick any moral, social issue that we're struggling with right now. What are some of those? Abortion rights, gay marriage, stem cell research, the war, the death penalty, doctor-assisted suicide, you can name a bunch more. Society's struggling with these issues, right? You can't name a single issue on which devout, Bible-believing, praying Christians don't fall on both sides of those issues. Look at the marches. Christians are on both sides. They have the same book. Paul wrote in the Bible, God is not the author of confusion. But can you think of a single book that has caused more confusion than the Bible? Think about it. All these sects and denominations and groups, they all conclude to you that their little version of theology is the correct one. And they can open the Bible and show we have the right one. The others are all wrong in some way, either radically or even they're even going to hell because of it. So I think there's pretty good evidence right there that Christians don't agree on the definition of a God or on the moral principles of this God. And Paul said, if the trumpet gave an uncertain sound, who's going to march to battle? The Bible gives a very muddy, immoral, amoral, uncertain guidance about how we should live our lives. It is irrelevant to today. God believes it's irrelevant to how we solve modern problems. Number five, there are no answers to the positive arguments for the non-existence of a God. For example, the problem of evil. You probably saw Mark Ehrman's new book, God's Problem, which shows that even the Bible itself is contradictory. The Bible gives different answers as to why there is evil in the world. All you have to do is walk into any children's hospital and you know there is no God. These parents who desperately love their kids, who are praying desperately for these children to be healed or saved or whatever, these kids die, sometimes horrible deaths. If there were a loving God, there would have been no Holocaust over his chosen people that he promised to protect. If there were a loving God, we wouldn't have all these tragedies. And that a God who really cares and loves, the problem of evil is insoluble. Theologians admit. It's easy to come up with a pat answer. Oh, well, we have evil because of this or that. And there's five or six different theodicies, but none of them are satisfactory answers. If you had known what the terrorists were going to do on 9/11, and you had the power to stop them, with no risk to yourself, would you have stopped it? Would you? I sure would have. If I could have stopped, I could have given them a heart attack, or made the flat higher than the plane, or something. If I could have done that, I would have done that, right? And you, how many of you would have stopped the evil from happening, right? Well, then you're nicer than God. Because God knew about it, God could have stopped it, God promised to answer prayers, God listened to the prayers of those believers who were in that building that day, who were trusting that God bless America, and yet he doesn't. If he exists, he's an accomplice to the crime, because he could have stopped it and did not. Number six, there's no need for a belief in God. Why bother with the belief? Why torture ourselves with this unprovable, incoherent, contradictory idea that no one can agree on, no one can prove, when millions of good Canadians, millions of good Americans, millions of good citizens on this earth live happy lives without this belief? We live moral lives, productive lives. We have families with family values. We care. We give. Actually, you know that non-Christians, at least in my country, non-Christians as a group, give more to charity than Christians. Did you know that? As a group. Atheists and agnostics as a group are more charitable than born-again Christians are as a group. Of course, there are some wonderful born-again Christians. I would never say Christians are bad. Wonderful people. They're kinder than Jesus, but they're smarter than the God of the Bible. It's to their credit that they have risen above the brutality of that horrible book, and they're good people in spite of their faith, and that they've joined us humanists who really understand that the real solution to morality is working on real natural problems in the natural world, using natural means and using a rational process rather than following a list of dogmatic rules or creeds. Think of the people on this planet that have really good lives, not working with the idea that, oh, I might go to hell. Or I might not get to go to heaven. Jesus said, they who are whole don't need the physician, only they who are sick. So if you're sick, you don't go to the doctor, right? Jesus said he came to save us from sin. The Bible says Jesus came to die for our sins if we accept him into our hearts as I did in our upbringing. And we confess our sins and accept him, he'll be coming to us and make us a new creature and all that. We can be saved from sin, from the wages of sin and death. We can be saved from all of that. But what if you're not sick? What if there is no such thing as sin? What if sin is only a theological concept, which voila has a theological answer, solving a problem of its own making? What if it's like a doctor who runs around cutting people with a knife in order to sell them bandages? Right? Would you have no respect for that? You say, well, why are you cutting me? The Bible has a pessimistic, insulting view of human nature that we are all bad. We all can't think on our own. We're all sinners. We're all broken. We all can't find any happiness in life unless we go to the doctor. Jesus said, they who are whole don't need the physician. So, if salvation is the cure, then atheism is the prevention. You don't need the sickness to start with. You don't have to have the sickness. You can live your life without the thing for which there's no evidence or no coherent definition or no logical argument or no need. Suppose you were in prison because you've been convicted of a horrible crime. Suppose you were there for a while and then you learned that you were going to be released from prison. Freedom. I'm going to be free. I'm going to be set free. How would you feel? I feel pretty good, right? But what would make you feel better? To learn that you were set free because of the good graces of the pardon of the governor? Or to learn that the reason you were set free was that you were innocent at the time in the first place? What would make you feel better? What would give you more dignity? We atheists and agnostics are innocent of the crime in the first place. There's no sin. There's no need to submit. There's no need to feel bad. We're not perfect. But we have this life so that, in fact, any of us feel that since there are no good arguments for God, or no good evidence for God, that we are better off spending our time working on the problems in this world alone, in this real world, alleviating real harm. You say time's up, or is it?
Pretty late.
Oh, very good. That's good. So, listen to Peter tonight and ask for evidence, ask for a coherent definition, ask for a falsifiable statement, ask, and it'd be more than just a God of the gaps argument for the existence of God. Thank you for your time, and we're looking forward to an enjoyable rest of the day.
Secular humanist for putting this event on. Could you change the microphone? We'll discuss the view of prayer later on. Thank you to the Niagara Secular Humanist for putting on this event. You know, I thought you were called the Niagara of Free Thinkers, which I kind of like because I consider myself a very free thinker, but secular humanist maybe a little too much for me to join. And Freedom from Religion, well, that's not a bad title for an organization either. So thank you for putting this on. I hope you're going to have a nice, both intellectually stimulating and a spiritually stimulating night together. And for those who are not accustomed to debates, but first of all, let me just have you say, Graham's a moderator, a person I've known for a number of times. He's done some interviews over, done a fair job with me. He did tell me that he still switched over to atheism. And I'm a little concerned about the promise to be fair, good moderator. Actually, I like that you're here. The more atheists come into this gathering, the better for that, as far as I'm concerned. So I welcome you, Grant. And, you know, I've only done one debate before in my life. 12 years ago, I did a debate at Brock University, and on the other side were three professors of philosophy, and I thought the debate went pretty good, from my point of view, and I was asked to go to other universities and debate, but it really wasn't my fault. So two things caused to stir my interest tonight, and one of them is my oldest son, Peter Carl, who at the debate 12 years ago was a gentleman at Waterloo University, and actually I was debating one of his professors. I think he was still debating his own beliefs at that time, and since then he has become, of course, a believer in Jesus and works with me at the Celebration Church in the Toronto branch of it, and is my senior associate pastor. He's also studied a lot of these areas of philosophy. And, you know, we still have a little father-son rivalry. I don't want him to beat me in tennis or in street hockey, and I don't want him to beat me in Christian apologetics either. So I thought this might be Dad's chance to just keep up, spend a couple of days, you know, reviewing what I believe and think about these things, but I got a good son, man, so if I'm an easy target, you can always tackle him afterwards. But the other thing that intrigued me was you, Dan, because I've debated sort of the professors of philosophy, been there, done that, but So at first I actually said no to this invitation to my assistant, but then I said, who is this Dan Mark? And they told me that you had been working with Captain Kuhlman, you had been involved in Christian ministry, and I've never really quite met an atheist like you. So you're the reason I'm here, Dan. I felt that would be a new angle to it. All right, enough greetings. Please start counting my 15 minutes right now. I don't have to count. Those were just nice words I had to share with you. Well, here's why I say God exists. Now, let me say, first of all, I'm not going to rebut. There were many things in what Dan Barker shared. Some of them I think were just blatant untruths, if I may say like that. There's many, I want to pick up many of those threads, but I will do that in my rebuttal. I will do what was my prepared introductory speech right now, and so though I don't touch on the areas that Dan mentioned, they will be coming up later on. But I believe God exists, not only that God exists, but He is revealed in and through the person of Jesus Christ. I believe there's much evidence for this. Faith in God makes sense beyond just being rational and logic. The gospel of Jesus does respond to humanity's deepest need. Atheism, however, is a leap of faith which sorely lacks evidence. Atheists often ignore realities and pose questions without seemingly paying any attention to the answers offered. I'm not against atheists. I was raised in a country that is considered the world's number one atheist country. I believe when I went to high school, the official stat was 46% of the Swedish population considered themselves atheists. About half of those were still members of the state church, but nobody attends, so it didn't matter much. I grew up with atheists. Most of my friends growing up were atheists in my early years in school, grade 1 through 6. My teachers were nice Lutheran ladies. After that, it was pretty much all atheists. I believe my Christianity teacher was an agnostic, so that was an improvement. But otherwise, they were all atheists. And so I played with atheists. I played cops and robbers with atheists. So, Dan, I want to know, I know atheists are nice people. And I have no bias against them because I spent my growing years with them. Now, however, if I compare the debate 12 years ago, maybe I wasn't so much in tune on the current debate, I've noticed that there is an aggressiveness in the current atheistic debate. You read some of the well-known writers like Dawkins and Hitchens, Sam Harris, even our own, who's passed away, Charles Templeton, and Dan Barker's book, there is an aggressive tone. And I would submit to you that this kind of tone of rage and anger that could be caused by the fact that it is becoming increasingly difficult to be an atheist. In the face of scientific advancement, it is very difficult to really claim and stand straight to your face and say, there's no cause behind this. We can forgive people 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago, but science is advancing. And so the argument you're going to hear, let me summarize the argument in the current debate, and you've heard some of them already. Faith in God lacks rationale. Miracles just don't happen. Believers are at best deluded simpletons, or they are smart, intelligent people who leave their brain at the door when they go to church. As Sam Harris, well-known current author, says, faith is nothing more than the license religious people give one another to keep believing when reason fails. That's what he believes. Daniel Dennett, who I'm sure you will hear maybe quoted tonight, says, people of faith consider it demeaning to ask God tough questions. Really? I wonder what church he attended. Carl Sagan said, the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. That is surely a leap of faith. So atheists are truly believers. Secondly, you're going to hear that faith, or you might hear, I don't know what my Dan will share, but this is the current atheistic debate, you will not hear that faith in God is damaging to you as an individual and to society. Murder, wars, violence, oppression of women are all perpetuated by people who have faith in God. The believer lives in a tormented, oppressed world, fearful of an angry God, and can be delivered into the happy, joyous society of the free thinkers. And you might also hear that the Bible is not a good book at all. There's really nothing good about it. Instead, it portrays a petulant, cruel, wicked God who oppresses and enslaves his subject while he demands their adoration and praise and worship. You may hear that Jesus Christ is not very good. In fact, you may hear suggesting that he never even existed. The whole story of Jesus is just a myth borrowed from other legends and stories in the centuries before the supposed birth of Jesus Christ. The Old Testament prophecies are just after the fact orchestrations by people who wanted to make the story good. You'll hear that evolution is the answer. We don't need God anymore. Darwin's theory has made belief in God unnecessary. Now we know of the human origin, we know about human origin, and that faith in God is only, as you've already heard alluded to those who are not really learned, the weak, the sick, and the hopeless. Those weak-minded people who go to church and worship God. And then you might hear, and this is based on Daniel Dennett's theories and others, that biological and social revolution explains how religion and faith developed. Really, God didn't create people. People created God. And you might hear strange stories about you know, little noises in the dark that you can't see, and little inanimate objects that appear strange, and that in the beginning of time with primitive man caused him to think that there was something unknown, maybe a god or a ghost or whatever. You will hear that the idea of sin and atonement and sacrifice is brutal. And you've already heard it said that the very concept of sin comes from the Bible. Merely God is like that person who would stab you with a knife and then offer you a hand. Now, let's say, hypothetically speaking, that I proved tonight to be a very inept debater, a very inarticulate. On every one of these points and other points that may come, it is proven tonight that Dan Barker will beat me to a pulp. He will win every argument, and I will prove to be inarticulate. I will prove to be inept. I haven't done my homework. I provided no evidence. Let's say, no, I don't think that happened. But let's just say, well, if that was to happen, Dan Barker or the atheist would have proven nothing about the non-existence of God. But of course, he's already covered that in his opening address. Because he said that in the debate, the burden of proof is always on the affirmative. Says who? No, the burden of proof is on the one who lacks in evidence. If we were debating, is this the month of April, and I would speak for the affirmative, I would suggest that the burden of proof would be the one who is speaking for the negative. The one who lacks the evidence. So let the audience decide where the evidence falls tonight. And let not the atheist escape so quickly and say, I have nothing to prove. You prove it. Let's see who has the evidence. The atheist, let me go on here. I got so much to say. The evidence, yes, we've heard references here to the cosmological argument, the teleological argument, you know, the watch as a watchmaker, the argument of design, the first one is cause and effect, argument of intelligence, the idea of man's and nature's intelligence presupposes a higher intelligence, the ontological argument, that of man's intuitive knowledge of God, the biological argument that only life can produce life, the moral argument, and that was alluded to as well. I look forward to discuss that in a rebuttal. Is there a universal law? Is there a universal law here? Or is it all relative, that every group of people have their own relativism, individual or in a group? Is there a universal law? If there is, there must be a universal law here. Going back to the second argument of design, you know, we live in a world today where we know that every single human cell in your body, every cell in your body, has over a million components in it. Every cell in your body, and you have a total of 75 trillion in your body, is more intricately and complex than the most complex piece of machinery ever made by man. There's nothing close to it at all. Every cell. But with that kind of evidence, it becomes difficult to say, oh, it just happened. Every cell is capable. We discussed that one. Are believers really weak-minded, dim-witted? You cannot, as Dennett said, you know, you're discouraged from asking God any tough questions. What about Mary when the angel said, you're going to conceive and bear a son? She said, how can it be? What did the angel say? you blasphemer, Mary, you, why do you question God? No, the angel went on to explain. He gave actually three particular pieces of advice to Mary. What about Thomas, who said, I don't believe unless I get to touch the wounds in your hand and in your side? What did Jesus say to Thomas? Did he say, oh, you are blaspheming me, you're not allowed to ask any question? Knowest thou not that I am God incarnate? And thou beest quiet. Is that what Jesus said? And that's not the book of Proverbs, deplore ignorance. Now, there is blind faith. Of course, there are many Christians who just believe in Christianity and blind faith. They have many atheists who also have blind faith. Just like there were blind Nazis and blind communists and blind capitalists, there's blind in every area. Now, I want to skip something. I'll say that for later there was a reference to. But atheists, and the suggestion was made that atheists are not believers. They are big time believers. One of the books on our table is by Norman Geisler that says, I don't have faith enough to be an atheist. And I recommend that book too. There's two kinds of atheists. Very pretty. Nietzsche, who also influenced Adolf Hitler in his ideology, said, if one were to prove this God of the Christians to us, we should be even less able to believe in him. So there are atheists who are open minded, and there are atheists like Nietzsche, whose problem is not really rationale and intelligent discussion, but it's in their will. But now, I'm getting to my will again. So that wasn't it. No, I have 5 minutes left. Perfect. Now, you know, when I accepted this, I have read a lot of books. I've read Hitchens, I've read Templeton, I've read many of the books, Sam Harris, many of the current arguments, and I've read that part of his book also. I don't know if you read mine, but I'll give you some. Except I don't have books on this topic. And you know, I'm kind of upset that, oh, there's outrageous attacks on Christianity. But I never recognize myself. I never see anybody seemingly atheistic thinkers who even grasp what the message of the Bible is. So I thought, when we would have someone who's been a preacher, pastor, associate pastor for, I think, over 19 years, I thought he'd hear someone who at least has grasped our message. But I hope today I can say something, maybe, Dan, if you haven't heard other preachers. I've only heard one debate that you did, and that preacher was pretty well held fire of damnation. And finger wagging. You know, you said, what are your quotes? What are the quotes of Dan Barker, atheist? 19 years of ministry. How happy can you be when you think every action and thought is monitored by your judgmental thoughts? Well, I would say for an atheist, former preacher thinks, if that's his view of God, I would say I applaud Dan Barker for staying in the ministry for 19 years. He deserves a medal for endurance. If that's what God was to you, a judgmental ghost who monitored every action and thought, if that's what God is to me and the people in our church, I think we would have joined the Niagara Secular Humanist a long time ago. What a perverted view of God. Is that... that I can see that Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and others think about it. But sadly, I don't want to put the blame on you for this, Dan, because I know there's vast numbers of Christianity where it seems to be, as I've read in your book, it was all about preach hellfire, damnation, Jesus is coming back like tomorrow, and get everybody pushed into saying the sinner's prayer and assign the name and address and just get them ready for heaven. But you know, that is not the message of the gospel. At least if we're going to criticize the book, we should know what it says. At least if we're going to critique the Bible and say just a bunch of garbage is nothing good, we should know what it says about itself. This would be a logical saying. This is showing respect. Jesus said it. But we can discuss the veracity of what Jesus said. But let me proceed with what Jesus said. In Luke 24, he shared with the disciples, beginning with Moses and all the prophets and Psalms. And he explained that the whole Old Testament is about him. He's pictured. Paul says, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, that many, and I suggest the atheists are in that group, when they read the Old Testament, they have a veil over their face. They can't see it, but the veil is removed in Christ. Certainly everyone has noticed that the first six letters of the word Christian meant the word Christ. That ought to be quite simple. And in fact, to understand the Bible at all, according to the Bible, according to the New Testament, to even begin to comprehend the Bible, you must see it through Christ. You must see it through that He is spoken of, He is prophesied about, and then the New Testament, in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, He's explained and declared. We don't love God because we're afraid of hell. We don't love God because He's a judgmental ghost. We love God because He first loved us. He's not a judgmental ghost. The judgment that every human being should have received for our sins, that judgment fell on Jesus. So there's no judgmental ghost chasing him. That's the message I share with Muslims, Buddhists, atheists. I've been all over Russia, all over Albania. That's when atheism fell. That's the same message, and people receive it with such hunger and such thirst, because there's certain things, certain matters of the heart that cannot only be explained in the head, though the head plays a vital role in the explanation. And so there is a hunger in the heart of every person that is satisfied by what God did through Jesus Christ. So, be a free thinker today. Open your heart. Consider what Jesus said. Grant, am I done? He said, it's over. I didn't want to hear on that either. Okay, thank you.
Better for you to cut off an eye than to lose your whole body into hell. He was pretty brutal. He was pretty gruesome. He had punitive, judgmental attitudes towards all of us. If you properly read the Bible, it should be read not through the eyes of faith, but through the eyes of learning. But I noticed something tonight, and I'll talk more about Jesus later, because I used to feel like you do. I used to think there was this heart relationship to Jesus, and I used to preach sermons very much like what Peter preaches, so I do understand your attitude. And your attitude really is good. You want to be a good guy. You want goodness in the world. You want to stop misunderstanding. You want to stop violence. You want to stop hurting and pain, which is what we humans want to do as well. So we're on the same page, and I think our similarities are much more than our differences. But notice that he talked about the burden of proof is on the person who lacks evidence, and yet did he give us any evidence? Did he present one piece of evidence tonight for the existence of this being that he's arguing for? I didn't hear any evidence. I heard maybe the Bible, but before we can use the Bible as evidence, we have to first prove the veracity of it and its relevance and its authorship and its reliability. And I think most of us in this room realize that Bible scholarship is showing that much of the Bible is not trustworthy. It is not reliable. Many of the documents contradict each other. In fact, we don't even know what the original documents are. There are verses in the Bible right now that you probably preach from that don't appear in any of the original documents. Do you ever preach from 1 John 5:15? I'll show you that. Okay, well, have you ever preached from John... you ever preached that verse in the Bible? John 5:17, where... there are three that bear witness in heaven, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are one. That's not in the original. That was inserted by the Catholic Church later. It's a phony verse that was inserted that no honest person should ever quote that as the Word of God, because it does not appear in any original document. It is a lie, basically, that you got stuck into the King James Bible. And if you've ever preached that verse, you're preaching a lie. Many parts of the Bible have later insertions in the Triple Nations through textual criticism we can see. In fact, I referred to Bart Ehrman, one of his first book, The Misquoting of Jesus, laid out many of those things. That any honest person who wants to ought to rip out of the Bible because they don't belong there. It was later Christians who stuck them in. It was a later believer who stuck that little passage about Jesus into the writings of Josephus, who never would have called Jesus the Christ. There was a whole bunch of tampering, borrowing, swapping, deleting, editing going on in the creation of this book. It is not a very reliable book. It does have some truth in it, obviously. It would be a true miracle if the Bible didn't occasionally say something good, as if it never would have dawned on us there was something wrong with killing, or there's something wrong with telling lies. So the Bible will have some goodness in it, but on balance, it is not a reliable book. So if you're using the Bible as evidence tonight, we trust we need to serve, we have to discard the Bible as evidence for God. I'm asking for evidence that we can look at. You accuse us, atheists, of not having evidence, therefore having a burden of proof. If atheism is fake, atheism is absent of faith. If atheism is a faith or religion, then baldness is a hair color. Atheism is a lack of a belief. Just like you lack a belief in Thor. You lack that belief. You lack a belief in leprechauns. You're an aleprechaunist. I lack a belief in theism, so I'm an atheist. I would also like to ask you, give me an example of rage and outrageousness and anger in the writings of any of these new atheists. I've read those books and I see gentleness, I see calmness, I see rational inquiry, I see justifiable anger, which you should be angry with too, as the extremism of religion. Obviously, if you're a moral person, you will join me in morally denouncing the actions of extremist religionists. So obviously, you and I both feel there ought to be some outrage. But where is the rage in any of my books? Jesus would judge. God of the Bible says it will be a day of judgment. He is a spirit. He is a ghost. The God of the Bible is a judgmental ghost. He created a hell. Any system of thought that has to make its point with a threat of violence such as hell is a moral violence such as hell is a morally bankrupt system. God created a hell. Jesus talked about weeping and wailing and gnashing, a place of punishment. And if God didn't send me to that place because I have the courage to think for myself, he is a morally bankrupt being that not only does not exist, he does not merit my approval.
All right. Thank you. I think my point is proven that atheists know how to throw out a lot of questions and not listen to any answers. There's been about 10 questions raised here. I'm going to choose a couple of them. Am I supposed to rebut what you said now? Which remains to be
you pick it up and I'll put you guys on level one.
Because you erased, four pages of questions here on that. So I don't know where to start. Let's just start from the beginning. I'll just start with a list of questions. First of all, Zeus, Allah, Yahweh, etc., etc., etc. That whole scripture is completely lacking scholarship. Zeus, you may, whatever he was described as. In the Greek, today the name for God is Theos, which comes from Zeus. It is fully understood by the Greek people that the word Theos from Zeus is a reference to the Almighty God. Same with Allah in Arabic. In Korean it's Hananin. In Chinese it's Sangti. In Balinese, Hinduism, it is Sanyang Vidivasi. I can give you names for God. Finnish is Jumala, in German it's Gott. And so this idea of these tribal gods, there is one God, and that was understood by the Hebrew people who created heaven and earth, is the God of all people, not a tribal God. And you can go back and study this. A few weeks ago, was among a tribe that just came into civilization, the treetop tribe, the Korowai people, in the interior of Papua. You can study Don Richardson's books, and this idea that people came from, they believed in ghosts and spirits, and then eventually they developed a faith in one God, and monotheistic religion, and being the evolved religion. First of all, it's a big slap in the face of the people of India and Nepal, who are Hindus who believe in polytheism right now, and Bill Gates, that they're very smart. So they're not exactly secondary people. But the idea of slaying people fits really in with evolution. We know that evolution influenced Hitler in his thinking of the Übermensch. And even what you're saying, you're calling people to go to church, weak-minded, sick people. This is the kind of thing that is not, it's demeaning, it's a put-down of people. Moving on from that, Every scientist in the world would jump at the evidence of God. But I'm going to give you scientists right now, if I have time, who you refer to in your book. He's quoted in your book. His name is Anthony Flew. I may run out of time here. Anthony Flew is referred to in your book. He's one of the reference materials you have in your book. He's considered to be maybe, of the last 30 years of the 20th century, the number one atheist in the world. Well, he's changed. Let me just quote Anthony Flew. His whole book, There Is a God, is down there. You quote him as a source for atheism in your book. He's referenced, and you encourage people to listen to his debates. Here's what Anthony Flew says, as far as his conversion. He's not a Christian, doesn't believe in Jesus. He's converted from atheism to deism. He's considered, as I said, the number one atheist propagator in the last 30 years of the 20th century. He says there were two factors in particular that were decisive. One was my growing empathy with the insight of Einstein. Imagine that. Einstein could help someone to believe in God. I guess there was no empathy. I heard it said every scientist in the world would jump at any evidence of God. Anthony Flew jumped. He listened to Einstein, another noted scientist, that there had been an intelligence behind the integrated complexity of the physical universe. The second, he says, was my own insight that the integrated complexity of life itself, which is far more complex than the physical universe, can only be explained in terms of an intelligent source. I believe that the origin of life and reproduction simply cannot be explained from a biological standpoint, despite numerous efforts to do so. With every passing year, the more that was discovered about the richness and inherent intelligence of life, the less it seemed likely that a chemical soup could magically generate the genetic code. The difference between life and non-life, it became apparent to me, was ontological and not chemical. The best confirmation of this radical thought is Richard Dawkins, who I know you also refer to, comical effort to argue in The God Delusion, his famous book on the New York bestseller list, that the origin of life can be attributed to lucky chance. If that's the best argument you have, then the game is over. And Anthony Flew says, I didn't hear a voice. It was the evidence that led me to my conclusion. Dawkins is selective to the point of dishonesty when he cites the views of scientists on the philosophical implications of the scientific data. So here again, I remind you, this is a man that you yourself has quoted as an authority on atheism. And then Flew stated, it now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. It has become inordinately difficult even to begin to think about constructing the naturalistic theory of the evolution of that first reproducing organism. I had to go with the evidence. So is that evidence I've come up with? Is that not even good enough for evidence? Is one of your own mistakes? Is my time up or can you go?
Oh,
well. I mean, that's law of gravity was used several twice. Law of gravity was used. Like, we all believe in that. But I like to have Don Mark explain that. No one can explain that. Oh, if you ask the scientists what is gravity, they say it's graviton. Well, what is a graviton? How do they work? No one can explain gravity. There are many inexplicable things in nature. I heard
Thank you, Peter. Now notice what he just did. Instead of giving us evidence that we can test, measure, analyze, debate, he gives us gaps. He gives us what the ancients had, like with Thor and Zeus, and that they didn't understand. Those gaps are closed. We don't need those gods anymore. We needed a Hera. They were polytheistic. They had gods of fertility. I don't think Hera would have been considered the big god. There were many gods within the Greek and Roman system. But now that we know more about crop fertility, that goddess is not needed anymore, and that goddess has died out. Those gaps close, those gods die out. And notice that Peter's not given us any evidence for the existence of God. What he's done is he's given us evidence for a current gap in our understanding. He's given us evidence for a problem that has to be solved. And those problems are what drives science. Science would come to a standstill if there weren't these gaps. Science, the historical record of the science, keeps closing those gaps. Who was Peter to predict, maybe he has to give the prophecy, that all the gaps have now been closed, and there are no more, and all the ones that are open will never be closed again. How do you know that? Science has been saying that forever. What's going to happen when those gaps do close in the future, that Anthony Flew refers to? By the way, Anthony Flew is not a deist. You correctly identified him as a deist, which means he does not believe in a God. Deism is not the belief in a God, a personal God. It's a belief in a force of some sort. But even then, Anthony Flew did not give any evidence for this being. What he did was he gave evidence for a current lack of understanding about how we can piece it together. Dawkins, by the way, does not say, all I feel is my lucky chance. He said it was the opposite of chance. And Anthony Flew, by the way, is hardly considered the leading atheist of the 20th century. He was a pretty solid atheist, and still something of an agnostic about the question of God. So I wouldn't use him. In fact, a lot of people question whether he even wrote that book.
You shouldn't. People can buy his books.
Excuse me. So yes, of course you can do it, but that book, I understand, was ghostwritten anyway. I don't think he actually wrote the book. Somebody here might understand. Actually, he put his name on it, but someone else wrote it, and then he looked at it and said, yeah. So,
look into it.
Somebody in the question can answer that better than I can, but that's what I read. In any event, Dawkins says natural selection is the opposite of chance. You've mischaracterized Dawkins, and so has Anthony Flew. So, and in fact, Dawkins says that arguments like Flew's are simply an argument from personal incredulity. I can't understand how this could be, therefore, I'm going to have to plug that gap with my God. Notice Peter has not given us any evidence for this being. In fact, the being you are positing as the answer to complexity, this being of yours, right, who has created this amazing, by the way, the cell is much more complex than just more than a million. There's more than like 3 billion components of every cell, if you count the genes, right, and the DNA. So it's much more complex than even you say. Let's say it's immensely complex, right? How could you and I have ever come up with it? What you are positing is that there is a being who's even more complex than that. Because the creator has to be at least as complex as the thing that creates in order to create. If you see a watch on the ground, well, you have to assume that the complexity of the watchmaker is at least as great, if not greater than the watch. So by positing more complexity to explain a simpler complexity, you have begged the question of complexity. You haven't answered the question, well, where did the complexity of God come from? Isn't the mind of the creator intricate and complex? Doesn't it function? Doesn't it have designs? Isn't it more wonderful than a watch or a human eye or a cell with all the billions of components? Therefore, you've answered nothing. You replaced one mystery with another mystery. These arguments are kind of like the person who says, how did engineers make all those rivers to flow right along the state borders? How did they make the Niagara flow exactly there on the border between the countries? How did that happen? Think of the cost. Think of the plan. Think of all the design that had to go into that. You're thinking it's backward. You think you see design in nature when it was the other way around. We didn't have to evolve the way we are. We were not the end product of some teleological purpose. The blindness of natural selection is its beauty. It could have been some other creature. It could have been nothing that evolved. I debated Norman Geisler, by the way, and he's wrong. It doesn't take faith to be an atheist. In fact, Norman Geisler, he's a biblical apologist, right? And he actually is pretty weak when it comes to cosmological and teleological arguments. So your arguments shoot themselves in the foot. You have simply assumed the very thing you're trying to prove, and that's known as begging the question. It's illogical, and your argument fails.
Well, I have a list of Einstein, I have a list of Anthony Flew, both respected scholars, and I'll go on and list another one. Of course, none of these are valuable, even though you quote them in your own book, once the evidence they claim is evidence. It's not just me claiming when I'm on preacher, I travel, but I do have ability to read. And the problem with the whole argument you're making is it only works with you. The moment you leave this room, nobody will leave. This is like a philosophical laboratory tonight. We can all play little games and say a few one-liners and make everybody laugh. But once you go out in the parking lot, nobody's going to stand in front of a car and say, there's no manufacturer. Probably this car could evolve into a 747 in no time. Nobody's going to believe it. But in this laboratory that we're in right now, this philosophical laboratory we've set aside a few hours tonight to have a little exchange of thoughts and minds, and I just sort of speak from my vantage point, not debating these issues very often. And so, to just write off these people who claim that they have evidence for God, they're no good. There's no answer to this. I don't accept this. Could it be that you're an atheist like Nietzsche, who just doesn't want to be convinced? Maybe your career is vested in this. Your career was vested in Christian ministry. Now you've switched, and I appreciate the fact that that was a big step. Let me give you another one here while I'm at it. Let's take from mathematics this time. You know, there's a lottery I didn't. You know, as unlikely as it is to win the lottery, somebody's going to win. So maybe the creation of the world was just like that. You know, it was kind of unlikely that it happened. Well, a very noted scientist, Dr. Emile Morel, formulated the basic law of probability, which states that when an occurrence of event, where the chances are beyond 1 in 10 to the power of 50, which is 10 with 50 zeros, if the chance is that, and I won't bother to say it any other way, 1 in 10 to the power of 50, then we can know for sure that that will never happen, regardless of the time allowed. And of course, that poses a great mathematical problem for the atheists, because there's no way that the creation took place or that what we see around us has happened with a chance that was lower than those that were Borel's limit. Noted astronomer and physicist Sir Fred Hoyle calculated the chance that life could have evolved spontaneously to be the chance at 1 in 10 to the power of 40,000. That's a lot of zeros. Noted physicist, astronomer, Hoyle wrote, "The current scenario of the origin of life is about as likely as the assemblage of a 747 by a tornado whirling through a junkyard." Now, interesting enough, because there was a Harvard professor who counted that and says, well, given vast amounts of time, biography professor George Wall from Harvard said, given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. The possible becomes probable. Problem becomes virtually certain. One only has to wait. Time performs the miracles. Wow, I didn't know that evolutionists believe in miracles, but all right. Thanks for looking out. However, again, that was disputed because a very noted Harvard professor, Elsner Barmore, using a scanning electron microscope, was testing slabs of stone taken from the oldest rocks able to bear fossils, 3.6 billion year old fossils. And he found fully developed bacteria in these old rocks, about the same time as it was believed that liquid water first formed on the earth. So that showed that the full form was there 3.6 billion years ago of that bacteria. So again, there's so many evidence. But of course, all these people, whether Anthony Flew, he's no good anymore, Fred Hoyle, Einstein, himself recognized that there was an intelligence, none of this matters. Then, what I'd like to take this on, because we can argue this back and forth, I got a whole list of statements. Let me see what else I wrote. You go to a children's hospital, you know that there's no God, Holocaust, God's chosen people. I want to talk about all these different things that you brought up. You kind of have the advantage in the debate. I'm the one giving answers to you. It takes a little longer time to give an answer than just throw out 10 questions, sort of, and then not bother listening to the answer, just coming back to what doesn't matter. But look at Peter, he's done it again. He's given no evidence again. That's probably going to be your comeback. Look at that. It doesn't mean I know this. I just say that there's no evidence. I mean, in your book, you said that I don't believe in God. You said that there's no evidence.
Do you?
Your opinion.
Do you want to speak directly to the question that you already raised, or do you want to respond directly to the points raised about the
Can we put evil to the next round?
Let's do it.
Yeah, there's lots to say about that. Yes, you can quote all sorts of people. You say that you're giving us evidence, but what you have given us, think about it, what you've given us are people who are asking questions. You're not giving us evidence for a God. You're not showing us what he's made of. You're not showing us what he's... You're not giving us things that we can test. What you're giving us are... What you're calling evidence is not evidence at all. You're quoting people who are asking questions, who are saying, how could this be? Right? Your answer to the question of the supposedly improbability of a going for 747, your answer to the question of that improbability is God, right? That's your answer to the question. I'm not asking, I have questions too. We all have millions of questions. I have a lot of questions about science and this and that. So let's ask all these questions, but now let's get down to the business. Your job as a theist is to provide evidence that answers those questions. You just keep raising questions and saying that that is evidence when it is not. Let me point out, you say you read Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion?
I haven't read the whole book. I've read Hitchens and Harris.
You haven't read the whole book, obviously, because he directly addresses and demolishes the very argument he gave.
Friends, he makes some such strange arguments, I felt he wasn't worthy to read more.
Boo! Call yourself a debater?
Okay. Well, I did find him quite worthy and quite admirable. And I found when I was a theist, when I was a believer in God, you were almost, but not quite, stooping to an ad hominem argument. When you try to attack me as being like Nietzsche, who simply does not want to believe. I'll let that pass, because that's not acceptable within any debate, to challenge someone. Yeah, because I can play the same game too. You don't want to not believe. I can say the same thing, right? Which is irrelevant to the facts. I'm supposed to feel bad. Oh, I'm the kind of person who doesn't. I wanted it. I loved it. I loved my Krishna. I left it kicking and screaming. I talked to Jesus. I saw what I thought would answer to prayer. I lived that Christian life. I had a loving relationship with this God if you think you have a loving relationship with. But Dawkins, why don't you read the rest of the book? Give it a chance, right? You want us to read your Bible. Okay, we'll read it. Read the rest of it. It directly addresses that argument you raised about the 747 by saying, among other things, that if there's a God, he's even more ultimate than a 747. Right? If there is a God who created it, instead of a hurricane going through a junkyard, then this God himself is more complex. What do you think is more beautiful, an airplane or God? Which is more wonderful, an airplane or God? Well, right? Which one calls for more of an explanation? This complexity here or this huge complexity over here? You answer nothing by simply positing a higher level of complexity to explain. And by the way, everybody knows, and Dawkins and others point out, that Hoyle's argument is really so outdated. No one uses that anymore because that mathematical odds are based on the probability of putting a bunch of atoms in a box and giving it one shake and then seeing if there's an airplane in there. Would we expect that to happen? It would be one in chances of 400,000 impossibility. It could happen, but it's so unlikely. No one makes that argument. No one. That's a straw man. What Dawkins points out and what evolutionists and what scientists point out is this. Natural selection is the gradual accumulation of tiny improvements over a long period of time. The human eye, for example, is not the best evolved eye on the planet. There is a gradation from simple light-gathering pigments to these slugs in the bottom of the sea to more complex and more complex. And then the human eye is actually kind of poorly designed. The retina are backwards, and we have a blind spot that we have to kind of hallucinate around. Squids and octopuses have better designed eyes than we do, which means, who was it? Was it Pinker who said God must love squid better than humans because he designed their eyes better? Science, if you do some reading, read the rest of Dawkins, but read some of these good writers and learn something about science and evolution instead of attacking straw men. What you've given us tonight is not evidence for a God. You've done exactly what Dawkins says you theists are guilty of doing. You're making an argument from incredulity. I can't understand how this could happen, so therefore there can't be an explanation, therefore God. That's not evidence for a God. That's evidence for your ignorance. It's evidence for my ignorance. Ignorance is what drives science. We are all ignorant. You can't just simply plug Thor into the thunder and say, I have an answer. You have to then explain Thor. What is your evidence for the existence of your God? I have 1 minute left. Okay. Wait a minute. Well, okay, let me just lay this out real fast, because we're going to talk about evil. Morality, to me, I can't speak for all atheists and agnostics, but to me, and I think most humans and atheists in the world who call themselves moral, and we're not all moral. By the way, Stalin was a horrible person, we admit it, even though he was seminary trained. Hitler was a horrible person. even though he was a member of the Catholic Church. And so we could find examples of horrible people on both sides and beautiful people on both sides. My definition of morality is simply this. You can be called a moral person if it is your intention to act in ways that minimize harm in the world. That's what morality means. There's no capital in morality. There's no moral code. There are no moral absolutes outside of the human species. I think relative to our species, we can say there are some absolutes relative to us. But if it is your intention to act in ways that minimize real harm in the real world, you can be called, by definition, a moral person, believer or not.
Well, you know, first of all, I don't think anybody suggests that Ford thought that an airplane was greater than God. I don't think it was necessary to counter that. I mean, he was really using the illustration. Nor was I thinking that an airplane was greater than God. I hope that was clear to everybody, but, you know, these little rebuttals back and forth. At the point it says there's an overwhelming evidence that a lot of people, a lot of scientists, are more knowledgeable in their field than either myself or Mr. Barker here. Lots of scientists, in the face of the overwhelming evidence of DNA, 75 trillion cells in your body, are saying there has to be a first cause. The only logical explanation to this is a first cause. And so you're saying that scientists are driven by not knowing. But when those scientists driven by not knowing, like Anthony Flew, then conclude, we have found an answer. There's a first cause. By the way, Anthony Flew, as you know, in this book, has not accepted Christ, but he is investigating the claims of Christ. He says this actually in his book. He has an interview with somebody else who is a Christ follower. And so when he reaches the conclusion that, the evidence is taken into God, well, why not accept that? So here is a scientist that says, I look for evidence. I was driven to find out. And as I'm finding out more, in the face of 75 trillion cells, 3 billion components to the cell, I'm asking you, is the best you have, like I read your book, and your argument goes like this, basically. Well, if God is the higher intellect that created all this, then who created God? You write kind of a nice, you're a good writer, you write a letter from God to the theologian called Dear Theologian, and you're saying, here I am sitting up in heaven, I'm kind of lonely, I don't want to talk to you, and I wonder who made me, what's my purpose for being? Is that the best you got in the face of DNA, genetic studies? Is that the best argument? That God, if God is the first cause, he must be sitting up in heaven thinking, how did he make me? Who made me so intelligent? I mean, if that's your best evidence against God, okay, I guess let everybody here judge and see. Each one will decide for themselves to study that. Whether the guys in this book and other people read it and find out, or Anthony Flew's book. Not to this matter of evil. And I say I'm a little concerned there because it seems these lines come all the time. It seems that AIDS is always talking about children with AIDS in Africa, or 9/11. You ask the audience here, would you have stopped the airplanes flying into the towers? And I raised my hand, and others did. And then you followed up with a punchline, well rehearsed. Well, you're more moral than you know. Nice. Excuse me. I wasn't right. Let me tell you a story. Before we discuss philosophically, I want to tell you about a girl. Let's call her Susan. That's not her real name. She lost her high school sweetheart. She has attended a celebration church. She's now living in Eastern Canada. She lost her high school sweetheart in the towers. That was the end. 6 months after 9/11, she was diagnosed with cancer. She came back to visit her family in Halifax. 3 months after the diagnosis, she was gang raped in the parking lot in Halifax, only to find out a few weeks later that the video of that gang rape was on the internet. And here's a woman who certainly can say that there's no God. She certainly would be. I would listen to her say, and say she's been a church attendant for quite some time before she moved to Halifax. You know what she's doing today? She's working in high school with kids who are troubled. She says, because of God's love, because of the reality of Jesus, she's doing the work she's doing, helping young people in trouble with a traumatic event. I understand you can explain that away, but before you use 9/11 as a punchline to dispatch your speech, I have the feeling sometimes that atheists are white men sitting in university offices behind their desks trying to think of good examples so they can further their argument. There's a woman there who could have said, there is no God. But she said, the God of love strengthened. I have stood on the mass grave myself in Rwanda with 276,000 bodies underneath. And been asked by Rwanda National Television, what is your message? Yeah, basically, I put my arms around kids with AIDS in Africa. To me, they're not just punchlines in my debate. I got much more to say on this topic.
I wonder again, if you go to the beginning of the question, the discussion on first cause.
We can't hear you.
Come back to the issue of first cause. I'll check.
What if it's the one on Friday?
Grand has so much power.
He was asking if we could delay discussing the first cause. Actually, we haven't really talked about first cause, and you brought it up for the first time tonight. I think you brought it up, I think you equivocated. We were talking about design, and then you switched over to first cause. But those are two different philosophical arguments. Cosmological and teleological don't really overlap, unless you come to the same answer for both of them.
So it's the argument of evil and existence.
Yeah, so let's talk about evil. I applaud that young woman who's helping, that woman who's helping the subway service. Okay.
Sorry for technical difficulties.
Hello. Must be my initial straight to show that the God you believe in has the power, and supposedly the desire, to answer prayers and to protect people who pray for blessing. Yet he stood by and did nothing. Consequently, you who would have done something are nicer than God. Maybe there is a God, but he's an evil God. Maybe he's a God who doesn't care. Maybe instead of God bless America, we should be singing God curse America and have a national day of curses because of all of them. There are people, Bart Ehrman is one example, who have looked at the Holocaust, which is not a joke, and have concluded the same thing. There can't be a loving God. If God is defined as a loving being, that God cannot exist. It's impossible. Otherwise, this problem, we would have solved the problem. That woman who is working with the troubled youth, I applaud her. In spite of all of her troubles in life, she's a wonderful person. There are many wonderful Christians in the world, wonderful Muslims in the world that I've met, wonderful Jews and wonderful atheists in the world. We all fall on a bell curve of what the kind of person we are. Many atheists who sacrifice and give. And I know an atheist doctor who pays to hike up the mountains of the Philippines to give free medical treatment to people while the Catholic Church is charging them for the treatment. There are people in the world who are good, and this woman should be applauded for her kindness and her humanistic concern for human beings. But what happened to her, she's using her God as a vehicle for her charity. Many of us do it without needing the vehicle. We just directly. I mean, if you're motivated by the fear of hell to be kind to other people, well, then that shows really how little you think of yourself, because you're thinking, I'm not going to do this unless I'm scared of doing it. Or if you're motivated by the love of God and the promise of heaven to be kind to others, well, then that shows how little you think of others. You're doing it for a reward. We humanists say we should be good for goodness sake without needing an excuse or a reason. If you need a reason or an excuse like God or Allah or whatever, then you're not being truly moral. You're not being truly humanistic. You're doing it for some other ulterior motive. So there are no what we call cosmic moral absolutes, because eventually we're all going to be gone. This is going to blow up. There was a time when we did not exist. It didn't bother us at all. There's going to be a time after we're dead. But we do exist now. By nature, we are human beings who recoil from harm. We recoil. We don't like pain. We don't like fire. Most of us. If you're mentally and physically healthy, most of us recoil from that. And by nature, we have systems of trying to minimize the amount of harm there is in the world. So every culture has come up with something. We didn't have to wait for the Ten Commandments or the Bible or your God to tell us how we should treat each other. In fact, there's much science being done showing the evolutionary origin of the development of altruism, not just in the human species, but in other species. There are genetic reasons for why we treat each other the way we do. They have nothing to do with some spirit out there, but have to do with us and our involvement in our own species, our love for our own species, and by extension, other species on this planet and the planet as a whole. We don't need a cosmic code. We don't need the Ten Commandments. And by the way, the Ten Commandments are a very poor moral code. Any one of us could have written a better code than that. So I don't think there's such a thing as evil with a capital E. That's a religious concept. We might use the word metaphorically. Even humanists might say there's evil in the world, not as something that's up there with a Satan behind it or some forces that are battles and principalities and powers that are fighting with each other. But in the sense that some people are not as mentally healthy as others, they're psychopaths or sociopaths or people who are causing unnecessary harm, we develop laws to protect ourselves from those people. We build prisons or mental hospitals, or we have systems of justice so that we can deal with attempting to make this world a place of less violence and more understanding. And the Bible certainly does not get us one whit closer to that.
Topic of evil versus good is a very large topic, and I don't know if that was a concession from you, Dan, but you did characterize people who believe in God to go and go to church, and people with low self-esteem, with low need, who are sick, and even sick. I don't know if you would characterize Susan that way or Susie that way, after what she's gone through, helping other people who see a weak kind of person who just, you know, looking for something, or is she a strong person? I suppose she could be committed to an institution if she wanted to. So I don't know how you would rate her on that. God's not nice. Does Christianity produce good? You know, let's for a moment play along with this philosophical laboratory. See, this is often what's considered one of the trump cards in a debate like this. Evil exists. God is good. Therefore, the supposed God is good. Therefore, God cannot exist. So there's always innuendos. So this is so. Let's follow that to its logical end, that reasoning. So if evil in the world proves the non-existence of God, what does good prove? Nothing. What does good prove? If evil proves there is no God, what does the good prove? Is it worth nothing? As horrendous as September 11 was, let's say a man was 40 years old. It was the worst day of his life. He was struck by evil. If that evil proves that there's no God, had he ever experienced anything good? Had he ever had a happy day? Had he ever experienced love, family? Well, if evil proves that there's no God, then my question, what does good prove? In other words, it becomes a stalemate argument. The atheist can argue, well, and of course we could start stacking it up. I did here, let me just say, for example, we just take one example here, the murder rate, which the United States has a notorious, and never mind, it's just so many murders. I mean, the year was 2004 that I have in my notes here. We could say that murder was terrible, but look at all people who weren't murdered. I know this sounds very callous, but in fact, if just the mere existence of evil, if that proves that there is not a loving God, then what does the good prove? So, going back to Susie, going back to Jesus, and we haven't talked much about Jesus yet, I want to get to that. This, because Jesus is the personification of God. The whole idea, the concept of the Bible is that the world is evil. And Jesus came as a light. And those who are filled with Jesus, those who walk with Jesus, they can be light. Others are good people. I told you in the beginning, I was raised playing games with atheists. So I'm nothing against atheists. I'm sure in the United States and in Canada, you meet many people who will call you names because you're an atheist. You will not hear that from me. I don't think you are less of you as a human being because you're an atheist. You know, and in the debate, of course, you can back and forth, but there's nothing personal in that, and I don't feel anything personal from you towards me either. It's just the intensity of the topic. But to go back to this, what is good and what is evil? Is there a universal law? I would say yes, there is a universal law. The Bible is so interesting. You know, the Bible says, thou shalt not lie. I know you know the Ten Commandments, but I don't think you know why God gave them, but we'll get to that later. Because I've read what you say about the Ten Commandments. I don't think you have any idea why God gave them. And I'm disappointed after 19 years of ministry of not knowing why God gave the Ten Commandments. But anyhow, let's leave that. He says, thou shalt not lie. But then you see that command is modified. In Joshua chapter 2, in a situation where two Jewish spies have their life in jeopardy. Rahab lies. She lies to save their life. That's the teaching of the Bible. I don't know if you're familiar with the philosophy, this is not from Christian philosophers, of the terms, I know you're familiar with the terms relativism versus absolutism. Are you familiar with lower order absolutism versus higher order absolutism? It's kind of a new way of thinking about it. In other words, the lower order absolutism is what many preachers use, and I don't think it's very good. They just say, thou shalt not lie, no matter what. No, the Bible does make an allowance by the universal lawgiver that when it comes to saving a life, then that law is modified. That is why we respect someone like Raoul Wallenberg, who reportedly saved between 10,000 to 100,000 Jews in the Holocaust in Hungary. He lied, he cheated, he falsified passports, he bribed, he did everything to transgress in the Ten Commandments. But we still call him blessed, we call him a good man, because according to the Bible, in the universal, by the universal law, there's an understanding that when you save a human life, there's a difference. The Bible allows it. I think the Bible is a fantastic book. It doesn't make these little nitpicking statements. And some preachers see, what I find, there's a common denominator between many atheists and fundamentalist preachers. You cherry pick verses here and there. You don't want to see the total picture. You cherry pick a verse here and cherry pick a verse here. That's what fundamentalists do, rather than seeing the whole story of the beautiful love of God revealed through Jesus. Sorry.
That's funny.
I wonder, Dan, as you proceed in your remarks, if you could maybe address the question that Peter asked several times, which was if evil disproves a loving God, what does the good prove? Maybe go from there.
Yeah, evil, and I use that word with a lowercase e, which is the existence of either unnecessary harm or unwanted harm. Because some harm is wanted. Like you get stuck with a needle that hurts, but it's to give an injection to save your life. You want that harm. So my statement is that moral people act in ways that minimize the total amount of harm in the world, which is not utilitarianism, by the way, but it's what morality is all about. Confucius said it better than Jesus. Jesus said, do unto others what you have them do unto you. Confucius, 500 years earlier, said, don't do unto others that which you would not have them do to you. Evil does not prove that there is no God. The existence of evil proves that there's no good God. There might be a God, but he's an evil. He doesn't care about it. He's indifferent, or he's active. The God of the Old Testament, by the way, was actively hurting people because he was punishing them because they rebelled against him. The prophets in the Old Testament, they said this God, you have strayed away so these famines come upon you. And so the God of the Old Testament is a brutal, megalomaniacal, bloodthirsty dictator that none of us should have any reason to honor. Jesus said, I and my Father are one. He said he's in the law. So we can't say, oh, Jesus was a nice version of the Old Testament bloody God. What you just told me about lying basically is a concession to situational ethics. You are joining us humanists in acknowledging the fact that every situation has to be judged on its own merits. You can't just make a hard, fast rule, thou shalt not lie. Sometimes you should lie. A woman knocks on your front door. She's bleeding. She's crying. She says her husband's trying to kill her. You bring her in. You try to clean her up, right? And then her husband comes knocking on the door later saying, do you know where my wife is? You better lie to that man. It would be the moral thing to do to lie to that man. Exactly. It's situation. There's no list. Okay, so the Bible is borrowing from humanistic ethics when it does that. Ethics came before the Bible. We have systems that there's three good commandments in the Ten Commandments, by the way. Killing, stealing, and perjury. There's three that are good. The other are irrelevant. And four of them are not even ethical at all. But we didn't have to wait for the Israelites to come along and claim the copyright to these principles as if we were so stupid that we couldn't have figured this out. It long predated Christianity or Judaism. Yet modern Christians think that, wow, we have a system of morality. You say you don't want to call names to atheists, and yet your Bible that you love calls me a fool. The fool has said in his heart. Do you believe Psalm 14:1 is right? That the fool says in his heart there's no God. That's calling names. Jesus said, whoever says thou fool is in danger of hellfire. And yet Jesus turned right around and called people fools. He contradicted his own teachings. So I applaud you and I thank you for not being so rigid as the Old Testament writers were, as the Ten Commandments were, and I applaud you for joining us in the 21st century and understanding what situational ethics is all about. There is no one simple, absolute ethical rule. What you say is the love of life. What I say is the minimizing of harm. If we can find a way, that's the principle, not a rule. Ethics is not a rule. You can't pull out a list from your back pocket and say, oh, what should I do when someone's drowning in the river? You know, there's no rule for that. You have to think. You have to use reason. You have to analyze the consequences of the various options that are available to you. You have to do your best to be informed about which of these consequences results in the least amount of harm, and you take that path. That's what ethical means. Does this pesticide hurt the environment more than this pesticide? You have to think. You can't just follow rules. We have to use our minds. That's called reason. That's called ethics. Christians are welcome to it. We share it with you Christians if you want to be ethical people. We'd love to march in the same parade with you. But don't pretend that the God of the Bible gives us an absolute moral code. He does not. Even if he did exist, he does not.
Peter, I just wonder, as we go forward, if you might have brought up in Dan's original remarks, and you disagreed with it immediately as soon as he said it, which was the Old Testament God is a war God. He's touched on this theme again about the punishment doled out by God in the Old Testament. So I wonder, as we proceed here, you might be able to answer that.
I should have double time because he throws out the questions and I'm giving the answers. This is the last thing you said, in 1947, the American Anthropological Association issued a statement to the United Nations declaring that there's no decisive way of showing that one culture's morality is superior to the other. In other words, it doesn't matter, it was all relative. Well, modern, more up-to-date, let's stay with the modern flow here, philosophers that are not Christians have considered that statement that everything is relative, that morality is relative, completely debunked, and I'd be glad to discuss that with you. Not to the God of the Old Testament. A little Bible lesson for everyone. Adam sinned. What did God do? God punish him? God kick him in the head? God burn him? No. God came lovingly to visit him. A couple of chapters later, we have the first murder. His name was Cain. What did God do to Cain? God came to visit him. Cain denied that he had murdered. God spoke lovingly to him. Finally, Cain knew he was caught. And then he asked God, whom he had lied to protect him. And God protected him. The Bible declares that God put a protection. What a loving, beautiful God to love a murderer so much. So we can study much of the Old Testament. Now there is a period called the period of the law. And the law was given for a specific reason. And I'm kind of appalled that you know so little about the Bible. I'm amazed. You can quote a few favorite verses here and there. We could discuss the jot and tittle verse. You didn't quote that right. You skipped half a sentence. You've got to study the whole thing, what it says. It's not fair just to quote a verse and then skip half a sentence. Because you could miss the whole point of that verse that you see. And you did, actually. But let's not even go there. But the law was given. Because what happened after Cain sinned and murdered, God protected him. Then next comes a man called Laban. He murdered several people. He said, hey, murder is no big deal. Because look what God did to Cain. God protected Cain. God is so nice. God doesn't care. He says, God did it too. If you help Cain, you'll help me. So in other words, people took sin very lightly. God never wanted to punish people for their sin, though God is holy, the teaching of the Bible. But to show people the seriousness of sin, that's why the law was given. God never intended one person to be able to be holy or live right by the Ten Commandments of the Law of Moses. The Bible is so clear. The Apostle Paul tells us that in fact the knowledge of the commandments caused them to want to sin more. It was a preparation, and the Jewish people were used as a case study, though God provided for them. They had access to instant forgiveness of sin anytime they wanted to, throughout the period of the law. We could go into all of that. Come to our Bible college and I'll teach you about that, about everything from the red heifer to the tabernacle and every kind of provision, so that none would have to perish under the old covenant either. But that whole thing was to show human inability. And you're talking how much the atheists are able to live a good life. In fact, none of us, in thought and deed, we all know that none of us live a perfect life. We all fall. And the gospel is, not that you get saved, get born again, and have a judgmental ghost chase you and monitor every act and thought. But the good news is, that's what the gospel is, the good news, is that God took the judgment for human sin and put it on Jesus. Jesus became our substitute. This is the love story that the world is eating up because it speaks to the wounded human conscience. That's the story. And so when you are talking about God, and you can bring up, I'm surprised you have these, you know, one word I noticed that you don't like is the word context. But you know, let's be fair. You say Psalm 14:1, the fool says in our heart, there's no God. And then Jesus says, don't call anybody fool, you're in danger of hellfire. And I'm surprised you haven't asked me more about hell. I want to talk about that too. The context is important. I think it's fair to say that I could take half a sentence out of any book and misquote it. So, you know, as much as you don't like it to be in context, it's always good when the verse comes under question. For example, I heard you quote a verse where you said that God says, I hate with a perfect hatred. But it's kind of easy to answer that verse. I've heard you quote, I create good and evil. I'm surprised you haven't brought that up. You usually bring that up. You really write on that Isaiah 45, 7. I've got some good things. Read the verse before and read the verse after. To say about that, I don't know if anybody ever told you these things. But, you know, don't cherry pick a verse here and there to give a smart comment of half a sentence here and there. Let's look at the total message of God's great love for all of us, especially me.
As you know, I have a whole chapter in my book about context. I do understand context. And it's usually believers, fundamentalist type Bible, those of us Bible believers who are guilty of the very thing they accuse us atheists of doing, cherry picking. Yes, there are some verses in the Bible that say God is love. But if you look at the Bible in the entire context, on balance, God is not a God of love. You can find a verse that says this or that and harp on that. But it's usually believers. It's usually believers like you who are cherry-picking because you have a preconceived idea that God is, in fact, a God of love. The God that you think you're in love with in your heart and in your mind is a good, loving God. And when I point out that the God of the Bible is brutal, a petty dictator whose vanity is so insecure that he has to kill people forever for not worshiping correctly. For example, the Ten Commandments. Honor the Sabbath to keep it holy, which is what? God's holiness. God has his Sabbath to keep holy. What happens when somebody does not honor the Sabbath? You know the story in Numbers. They found a man outside the camp who was gathering sticks on the Sabbath. You know that story. So they brought him to Moses and said, Moses, what should we do? He was picking up sticks on Saturday. When the Ten Commandments says you shouldn't do that, what should we do with this man? And Moses thought, and Moses said, this man should be stoned to death. So they took him outside the city, and they stoned that man to death. For what? What was the crime? What in heck was the crime? He probably was wanting to feed his family. He probably cared about his kids. And yet he offended God. God wasn't worshipped right. God was offended in some way. His holiness was hurt. This big creator of the universe is so petty that he'd ask to stone someone to death for violating his command not to do any work on the Sabbath. I bet you work on the Sabbath, whatever day you call that. I bet you've thrown away those verses as irrelevant and ancient and primitive. So. Well, okay, maybe so. I bet a lot of your worshippers do. They work on the Sabbath. They have found those verses are irrelevant. Those old laws are irrelevant today. In the teachings of Jesus, Jesus says, don't think that I came to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. He told his disciples, if you don't have a sword, sell your clothes and buy a sword. Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, then you must hate your family. He used that Greek word miseo. Look at it in context. Look at what the word says. He was like a cult leader who was insecure. He said, he that is not with me is against me. That's a paranoia that these small-time dictators have, which is not true. You can be neutral. Jesus said that if you lose in a lawsuit, pay double. Have any of you ever done that? Have you ever got a speeding ticket and paid double the fine? Why not? Jesus said you should do that. Jesus had very bad moral teachings. Jesus said, he showed how compassionate he was by saying there are some slaves that you ought not to beat as hard as other slaves because they didn't know better. He never once denounced slavery. He incorporated slavery, that brutal institution, into his parables as if it were the normal order of the day. Why didn't he give us some useful advice? Why didn't he say something about the germ theory of disease, like wash your hand before you eat? Why didn't this all-caring, loving God, why did we have to wait for science for 2,000 years to come up with that answer? And he was basically useless as a moral teacher. He didn't say anything about women's rights. All his disciples were male. God is a man, and he got a woman pregnant, and she had a son. It was the patriarchal attitude of those days. In Revelation, he says 144,000 male virgins who have not been defiled with women. They are the ones who will be crazy. As if women can defile men. This is ancient idea that women, that the Bible had, and Jesus had, and his disciples had, which is an insult to human nature. Jesus was arrogant, as you even pointed out. He said, I am greater than Solomon. He liked to revel in his greatness and his arrogance. He was angry. He looked at his disciples with anger. He took up a whip and he threatened violence to people who were basically practicing free enterprise. helping people to worship by changing money in the temple. He picked up a whip and was angry at people. If Jesus was our moral role model, I wouldn't want to live in the same block with him. You and I are much better human beings than Jesus. We are nicer than him. We have better ways of thinking. We have risen above the brutality and the primitiveness and the simplicity. Jesus said, the works that I do, you will do also, and even greater than these. Have any of you done any greater works than Jesus? Of course not. He was irrelevant. He was useless. He was not a good moral leader. And Peter, you should be ashamed to be in love with a man like that. You're better than that. I think you are better than that. Don't use Jesus as your evidence for the existence of God, for which you've given no evidence yet tonight.
Peter's response will be the last of our 5-minute back and forth. We're going to take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back for some Q&As with our two guests tonight. Peter.
Well, you see, this is how it goes. I just counted here. Mr. Barker raised 15 subjects in that 5 minutes. This is a good debate technique. If you don't want any answers, you just want to throw out a lot of questions of a doubt. Questions of a doubt. I want to say to my atheist friends here today, I wrote them all down. And I think the people in our church have the answers to these. These are not such complicated questions at all. If you came to our church every Sunday, you hear very solid teaching on these subjects. We understand the Sabbath. We understand the different things that went on. And I'm amazed that you don't even know what the Sabbath is. You never read Hebrews chapter 3 and 4. Our Sabbath is Jesus. We rest in Jesus. It's a picture of him. And I mean, if you want, so I don't know where to start. I have 15 subjects here. God is brutal, Sabbath, contradiction, peace and war, paying double for fines, Jesus threatening, what is this, I can't even read my own writing, slavery, women's rights, 144 male virgins, angry Jesus. Jesus is arrogant. He ruins people's business. He did greater works and he's useless. Okay, let me just say, let's just pick the area of contradiction. Let's just pick one of the 15 so I can say something sensible about one of these things. But I assure you again, I can give you an answer for all of them. Just give me the whole hour. No, I understand that, but there's a lot of questions raised here. Contradictions. Now, you can just go on a website and you can look at Dan's contradictions. He has a chapter with contradictions from the Bible. He takes this issue up. How could Jesus say that he's the Prince of Peace? And then he says, I came to send war. You know, what about peace in Bethlehem and goodwill towards all people? What about Paul says he's abolished the law? And what about, you know, Jesus said, I'm not going to take away the law. What about James says you're justified by works and Paul says by faith? These are elementary questions for anybody who's studied the Bible. There's no contradiction. So my question is this. My question on this. Think about this. Are these people so stupid? Because you'll find in books by the authors mentioned, and I will be glad to say why I did. Please ask me somebody why I think Dawkins wasn't worth reading. Basically, the Bible is orchestrations. Things were added later on. For several hundred years, these scholars who were bent on creating a lie and make the story good, they study all the Old Testament prophecies. And they fit them into the Jesus story. They fit it into the whole, the resurrection and the crucifixion story. So these were not dummies. They were pouring through the Old Testament scriptures to make the story of Jesus good. These people who we must say were intelligent, they were skillful forgers, according to the atheistic thinking. Would it be logical these same skillful forgers wouldn't notice these seeming contradictions? And by the way, your 50 contradictions is nothing. I got a whole book, 500 pages by McKinsey, on Bible contradictions. My goodness, same. These contradictions are worthless. They're worth absolutely nothing. Anybody can understand Jesus is talking about two different things. When he talks about peace, he's the Prince of Peace because the war is over. There was a hostility because of human sin. But since that sin had fallen on Jesus, there's peace on earth towards everyone. God has only peaceful intentions. But there would be some families where there would be strife because the mother would say, I want Jesus, or the father would say, I want Jesus, and the other one. Well, these contradictions, I asked my assistant to bring me the newspaper. I want to show you how the contradictions work. Please bring me my newspapers here. Because if you study, this is to sum up all the contradictions. I have the Gospel according to the National Post right here. Yesterday's edition. I have the Gospel according to the Globe and Mail. I have the Gospel according to the Hamilton Spectator. And I have the Gospel according to the Standard. Now this is how you find contradictions. You know, here's a story, several stories here. about the Harper Schreiber Inquirer. Oh, when we read that there's a man who's working here as heading up an inquirer called David Johnston. He's on the front page of the Gospel according to the National Post. But once we go to the Gospel of the Globe and Mail, we find out that Mr. Johnston is not just Mr. Johnston. It's on page 90. Mr. Johnston is now a professor from Waterloo. Well, that proves, right, what a contradiction. If this was a true story, wouldn't the National Post have noted that he was a professor? Why wouldn't they call him a professor? It means that the Globe and Mail must be written later because they wanted to add and make the story better. And the saddest thing of all is, there's no evidence of the story at all in the Sacred Understanding, which proves the whole thing is made up. There never was a Moroni. There never was a Schreiber. That's the logic. Thank
you. Can we get a round of applause for Peter and for Dan? Break, give everybody a chance to stretch their legs, and we'll come back for a Q&A and then some closing remarks from Dan Barker and Peter Guthrie. Thank you very much. So our technical difficulties only got one mic. Before we begin our question and answer, we have just a quick announcement from Justin Trottier from the Center of Inquiry in Toronto. So he's going to quick announcement from him, and then we'll go on to your questions. When you come to the mic to ask your question, you come up to the mic here at the center. I'll have to shuttle the microphone back and forth, but if you could speak into the mic as you take to the stand for the benefit of the TV crew that's filming. And please keep your questions succinct. No speeches and long preamble. A question for either one of the speakers directed to them or both of them. Whoever answers will have a 2-minute answer, and then the other gentleman will have a minute to respond if he so chooses. So I'll turn it over for Justin for just a moment.
Thank you. I'll be very brief, just a couple of minutes. My name is Justin Trottier. I hail from a place called the Center for Inquiry Ontario, where we work in close affiliation with the Niagara Secular Humanists in across Ontario. We are the largest organization in Canada dedicated to education and outreach, promoting science, reason, secularism, secular ethics, and freedom of inquiry, and also serving as Canada's first venue for humanists, skeptics, atheists, and freethinkers. Throughout Canada, CFI hosts leading educational events, robust social and community secular services, like our Coping with Our Religion and secular sobriety support groups. We engage in political advocacy, supporting science and secularism. For example, our strong stand in favor of one secular public educational system in Ontario. We also provide an open and comfortable meeting space and a library open every day for our community members. The best part of my job, and the reason I'm here in front of you now, is our campus outreach initiative. CFI has launched 24 campus free thought groups across Canada, spanning from Vancouver to Montreal, dedicated to providing a voice and a community for atheists, agnostics, humanists, skeptics, and free thinkers. This is quite unprecedented. Promoting a secular, humanistic, and rationalistic alternative to the religious communities on campus, providing education in science and critical thinking, and defending secular, pluralistic democracy. We recently launched a very similar group at Brock University in St. Catharines, and it's called the Brock University Freethought Alliance. I do urge you, if you're a student at Brock and affiliated in some way, to check out the display to my right, to learn more about us online at cfiontario.org, or to just come speak to me after the event is done. So that's it. Thanks for your attention, and enjoy the rest of the event.
Thanks very much, Justin. And again, thanks to the Niagara Secular Humanists and CAW Hall for allowing us to be here tonight. And again, a quick round of applause for Peter Youngren and for Dan Barker and Kyle tonight. All right, so if you just want to come up to the mic, and no stampede. So again, just keep your questions direct to one of the two speakers, and they'll answer, and we'll hopefully get through as many questions as we can.
Okay, I've got a question that's going to stump Dan. He will not be able to answer this one. Why is it that when a person is breathing their last, whether it be on the battlefield in Vietnam, Korea, or wherever, And my two brothers experienced this in Korea. Their comrades are on the battlefield, or maybe you yourself. When you get to the point where you're in an accident or whatever, you're in the hospital, you're breathing your last breath, and the worst atheist, the worst blasphemer in the world is asking for the parson, he's asking for prayer. Answer that one.
I think even Peter would agree with me that your scenario is just false. There are many, many, many non-believers who face death without even a thought of prayer or a calling upon God. We have members of our group. Kenneth Dunn, he gave me his dog tags. He refused to have religion put on his dog tags. He fought on some of the beaches in the South Pacific. He saw praying Christians killed. He survived by luck. He never once thought of praying to God. He never once thought of praying to God. When my wife had eclampsia and almost died in the hospital when our daughter was born, it was a horribly traumatic moment. It was scary. Neither of us thought. In fact, she basically died and didn't know it. But they got there in time to bring her back. Neither of us thought of invoking the power of some deity outside the universe. We thought of invoking the best medical care we could get in the Midwest, which we did. If a chaplain had come in our room, her blood pressure would have gone up. There's no way she'd respect. So your whole scenario is patently false. Many people say, I can tell you story after story, and I won't belabor you tonight, but it's a myth that there are no atheists in foxholes. There have been many atheists in foxholes who were not indoctrinated up ahead of time to imagine that there's some power outside the universe that you can invoke. Believers will invoke their God. Muslims will pray to Allah. You know, Catholics will pray to Mary or some saint. And whatever your culture is, atheists don't pray to anyone. We might jokingly say, "Oh my God," which, you know, doesn't really mean anything. But so I answer your question directly by saying that the premise of your question is simply flat out false. You want to repeat? We have 1 minute.
Let's follow in the same vein. Are there any real atheists? I think Mr. Barker here is proof that there isn't. There's a man dedicating his life to proving that somebody doesn't exist. Could this be another way of dealing with sin, with guilt? Could be. He will say, of course, no way. He may be insulted that I suggest that. He would be insulted. He's making a joke of it now. Good, and you all laugh. But really, in reality, 25 years is not a joke. We understand what the crowd responds to. In effect, Mr. Barker is dealing with the same thing that Hindus deal with, that Catholics deal with. How do you solve the sin problem? And one of the ways to solve it is, it says, it doesn't exist. It's all an imagination. So in fact, I haven't done and seen any research from Foxhole, so I have nothing to say about that. But it's a possible, it is a logical thought that could be behind what Dan Barker is doing. Because I can't imagine spending my life on proving something that I believe is not.
I have a question for Peter Youngren. Can you please tell us more about Dawkins and his book?
I know the planted question.
First of all, there's nothing personal in this. I hope any intensity in the discussion is just the nature. If you feel passionate about something, and I think both Dan and I agree with that. I've seen Richard Dawkins on the television show. Actually, my son Peter Carl spent 25 minutes with Richard Dawkins in Oxford. He studies at Oxford. I feel that Dawkins is very loud. He doesn't hear any answers. Answers are provided. He just shouts back. Now, one particular quote that turned me off as I was about to read his book is this. This is what Dawkins says about Charles Darwin and the book The Origin of the Species. Dawkins says, "Darwin devoted one brief chapter to the difficulties with his theory of evolution. It is fair to say that this chapter anticipates and disposed every one of the alleged difficulties that have since been proposed about the theory of evolution." To me, that is the height of ignorance. First of all, the fact is that Darwin did not devote one chapter to the difficulties of his theories. He devoted four chapters to it. Secondly, how could Darwin have dealt with all the difficulties with evolution that would come? He didn't know the role of mutation. He didn't know the complexity of the molecules. He didn't understand genetic science. He never heard of Albert Einstein. How could he possibly give an intelligent rebuttal before any of these things? He didn't know that your human cell, 3 billion components with 75 trillion cells. He didn't know any of these facts. So what it seems like, Dawkins doesn't want to face the facts. He wanted to sweep it under the carpet with one sentence, and I find him doing that a lot. And so as popular as he is, the New York bestseller list and all, I have lots of good books at that table I would recommend. Thank you. Did I go over time? You know that? Oh, I thought you said that was... okay, sorry, you got to speak up there. Because I hurried there now. And so I find that Dawkins in that area, he just doesn't address anything. It doesn't matter what is said, he just shouts over it. That's what I saw him do on television. That's what he's doing in his book. This is not a scholarly way to express yourself. To just make a sweeping statement. Darwin answered all the opposing views. Nothing more to be said. This is what he says in his book. It's not even, there's no logic to it. And so I don't have time to read someone like that. I've read enough atheist books. I've read Hitchens' God Is Not Great. I've read Sam Harris. Don't worry, I've read atheist books, and I get more convinced of Jesus the more I read them. Our message is fabulous, though. It's brilliant. But it really is.
And to that I say no thanks. Many of us are better than that. We've risen above this idea of sin. Thanks, but no thanks. And I lived it, and I know what you're preaching, because I used to preach that, and this appealing to the heart and the spirit and the emotions and all that. And it's very effective, and good preachers know how to do that. And you're a good preacher. But Dawkins did not say Darwin solved all the problems. What Dawkins was saying was that, to Darwin's credit, he did not run from the problems. Darwin said, look at the human eye. How could we imagine it? And you hear a lot of, you're not one of these Christians, but you hear a lot of Christians quoting that verse saying, see, Darwin could not solve the problem of the complexity of the human eye. But actually, Darwin went on from there. If you read the rest of the passage, if you're honest, you'll see that he did deal with them and anticipated solutions. Part of the genius was that even today, scientists have not solved all the problems of evolution. So there's no way Dawkins would have pretended that Charles Darwin, 150 years ago, next year is the 150th anniversary of the book, that he would have solved all the problems. He was crediting Darwin with being honest enough to admit that there are problems, and then he dealt with them in his way, in his own time, even before he knew anything about Mendel, as you point out. So that is an unfair accusation of Dawkins.
I'm quoting Dawkins exactly. He says that Darwin is
I
feel like second.
If somebody else asks, we can come back to it. But next question.
Well, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, question for, actually a couple of questions for Peter. Very simple questions. Maybe you can answer them. Am I correct to say that God created the universe, the planet Earth, everything, life? He created all life. Am I correct for that?
I think you're doing good.
Good. Okay. So why did he create carnivores, animals killing each other and eating each other, like we are too? We are breeding animals and killing them and eat them. Okay. Why? Where was he 14 and a half billion years ago when the universe was created? If he created the universe, is he 14 and a half billion years old? Can you answer that?
Absolutely. You know, we were addressing there, where was God 14 and a half billion years ago? Well, he was God. He was, he's from eternity. That's the whole point of the first cause, of the prime mover that caused everything to happen. He always was. Nothing else. There's no one else we can say of them that they always were, or he or she always was, but God always was. So you can go back 140 billion years or whatever number of billion years you want to go back. But the only thing that makes sense is that there's someone who is the first cause. And you know, atheists have a great problem with the Big Bang Theory, even though there's all kinds of indications of that, and that would indicate that everything had a beginning, the way the universe is expanding. There's lots of interesting facts about the Joes that God was there in the beginning. The way I see it, in the way that the Bible describes it, in the beginning, really, they weren't carnivores. They were eating herbs. And you know, the Bible story is that sin entered. And so the universe is flawed. None of us are trying to say that the universe in its present form is perfect. We have a flawed universe. We understand that. There is evil in this world. Nobody's trying to deny that, least of all myself. That is why Jesus came. That is why God can touch a person like Susie that I mentioned before. In this evil world, she can be a bright light to others. That is why in our church, we try, for example, to have a very friendly attitude towards, say, Muslims. There's a lot of hostility. I see my Muslim friend over here, and I think you know that that's true. We don't agree on things. It's not a matter of you agreeing with me and I'm agreeing with you, but I don't consider you anything else but a friend. And that's the way we operate around the world. We're not trying to create hostility. And I believe that's the spirit of Jesus. That's what Jesus did. He loved Samaritans, Romans, and Jews equally. Did not discriminate. When the disciples wanted to call down fire from heaven, Jesus, who you call brutal or something, said, no, I didn't come to destroy men's lives but to save them. So Jesus is beautiful.
So a wolf tears apart a rabbit because Adam sinned. Does that make sense? I mean, is that even moral or logical? What fault is it of the rabbit? This is just plain ludicrous, this idea that free will of sin caused evil to come into the world. Did humans have canine teeth? When Adam was created, did he have canine teeth? We have these canines which evolved over millions of years to rip open flesh of other animals. So when Adam sinned, did these canines just go down suddenly? Oh, now he's a meat eater? I mean, why does meat eating have anything to do with sin anyway? We know that from evolution and from biology that meat eating needs a way to survive. You need protein. You need to convert energy from the sun through plants to animals so that you can live. That's how we got here, by tearing apart other creatures. If God created this universe, he's cruel and he's a bumbler, because he really made a mess of a lot of this.
Dan, as I think of your argument,